Ethan, who was the first arrogant man who wanted, so to say, to replace God, or to play God, or relate claim on ultimate validity of doctrine, law and man? This one, I don't know what he was, but he was quite clever and capable. This was our old friend, the serpent, the Noha Shakadmege. Quite clever. And he told Eve, Ki yedei alikim v'yimacholchem enanu v'nifkechu eneichem v'yithem kelikim yedei mora. The job of man is to replace the Almighty. Nasa lo v'migdol v'reshe v'ashamayim. This is evil itself. And again, the Torah has forbidden arrogance, metaphysical arrogance. Where? While Adonai was forbidden by the 10th commandment, metaphysical arrogance was forbidden by the 1st commandment. Ronech Yad Hashem Rekecho, Le'yiloch Elohim Achirim Alponai. And the incarnation, the personification of irrationality, of arrogance, which is evil, is who? Noachah just said. But the Noachah, if we had him around, we could settle our account with him. But he's not around. That's what we understand under, by the concept Amalek. That at least what the Chachmei HaKabbalah and the Kabbalists have understood. Not a Bedouin tribe, not a race, but evil. Man Satan, who writes a code to kill and to oppress and to lie. And here, something strange happens. The Torah has portrayed orgiastic man, arrogant man, through two societies. The Deir Mahut, orgiastic man and arrogant man, in their societies, the aesthetic and the arrogant tyrannical society, by introducing two generations. As a rule, even though the Torah did it, the Torah meant to do it in order to show the transition. As a rule, orgiastic society succumbs to tyrannical, arrogant society. I would even say, orgiastic society gradually, little by little, piecemeal, turns into a tyrannical, arrogant society. A pleasure-loving aesthetic is ready prey to the intrigue, to the scheming of our hungry, satanic mind. He's too much involved, the orgiastic man with himself. All his talents are consecrated to the goods. His imagination sees objects of his desire, nothing else. He doesn't see people, he has no historical sensitivity. A Jewish man lacks historical intuition. He cannot behold historical vision. He's too much involved in the present. He's too much absorbed in heaven. The non-rational or geistic man lacks historical intuition, sensitivity to events. He doesn't feel the heartbeat of history. He is much absorbed in his hedonic experiences. He overemphasizes foolishly the ideal of freedom that happened in 1917 in Russia. If Kerensky had a little bit of intelligence, the whole communist revolution wouldn't have taken place. The other emphasizes the importance of freedom. He simply lacks the courage, the vision, and the power of anticipation. He lacks the predictive element in history. He does not experience history, since he lives just for the present. And little by little, his power is eroded, and he is replaced by the irrational man, who is time-conscious and future-oriented. That happened in Germany, when I was there so many years ago, in the late 20s, in the early 30s, another indulgent, permissive, and an age-long society, and the society in our country now is tolerated, even promoted the rise to power of a tyrant and madman. He was not, and the madman was not non-rational. Had he been in that, he would have never left it one day. He was irrational, with a peculiar demonic diabolical logic and weird thinking. He was dedicated to an absolute norm of his own thinking, the norm of immorality. And the same thing happened in the Western world, where the so-called youth movement, rejecting all norms, every semblance of regulated, self-limiting life, and preaching boundless liberty, freedom from all authority, are actually blazing the trail for irrational men to come and to take over. And the same happened in the time of Achishverosh. What do we see when the curtain rises on the first act of Megillat Esther? What do we see? What do you see on the stage? What do you see? A feasting, pleasure-loving, and pleasure-pursuing society. The Book of Esther did not spare words in portraying vividly, with refined artistry and sarcasm, the repugnant addiction of the king, the princess, courtiers, and servants to lascivious pleasure, to the incessant pursuit of an ever fugitive satisfaction, the habits of an orgiastic society that was tired and exhausted because of satiety, and yet anticipated another satiety to be tried, for the sheer novelty of it is clearly portrayed. Why was it necessary to perpetuate the names of the eunuchs, the names of the harem keepers, Shalgar, Hegoy, the brand of cosmetics used by the king's concubines, the foul and rude habits of the king himself, the scripture which is so tabooed about the life of Moses and Abraham, became suddenly so loquacious in narrating the story of the king's wife, Binkler, and the degenerate life of all? The answer is simple, because only in such non-rational environment could irrational men take the rise. Only people who were pleasure-pursuing had no fixity, no fixed norms, no ultimate validity, no doctrine. Everything was shifting like the sand dunes could tolerate a man Satan, irrational and destructive and cruel. Only people addicted to the beautiful and pleasant could stand by and watch the smoke rising from the crematoria chimney climbing to heaven.
Vayi b'mei Achashverosh. Do you know why this bloody nonsense happened? Because it was a Achashverosh era. Uvona chedemei and freedom from the moral norms. Vayi achar adorem haere, the society of Shashgas and Hegoy must produce a haven. It was true so many years ago, it is true today as well. Now, if you are not tired, nor bored, I would like to tell you what is the Jewish approach to the finiteness awareness. How do we handle that? We saw modern Manhattan in two different ways. In an arrogant way and an hedonic way. Of course, Johannes, as I said before, objects to the two solutions, which orgiastic and arrogant tyrannical men suggested. Johannes asserts that the mamakim awareness can never be cast off. Never. Woe is to the man who tries to shed off the mamakim awareness. Can never be cast off, suppressed, or changed by them. The latter must leave, must abandon those childish satisfactions they had in A and the big lies. Make, reconcile with the finiteness awareness and abolish all things of spiritual dwelling. And Johannes developed, in my opinion, four aspects of the finiteness awareness. There are four dimensions to the finiteness awareness. First of all, the metaphysical dimension. Men cannot and must not attempt to suspend the finiteness awareness, for the latter is interwoven into the texture of the I-exist experience. Hence, men alone is unable to free himself from all the symptoms of that awareness, such as the feeling of loneliness, boredom, frustration, anguish, fear. Man is certainly incapable to defeat death. Salvation of man can come only from God. His companionship will heal man from the anxiety of being incomplete, finite, and patient. It is principle number one. Science will never solve the metaphysical problem of man. And all my respect to the psychiatrist will never heal man from the finiteness awareness or from the experience of ma'amakim or minametzah kawasiko. And don't listen to the beautiful, so to say, beautiful exposés and lectures delivered usually by non-scientists, by platitudinous people, about these prospects of psychiatry and the knowledge and the science of the mental processes of man. They'll solve the existential problem of man, never in the life. Because solve the metaphysical, and I speak about psychiatric problems. I want you to know, insanity is a psychiatric problem. Metaphysics does not know insanity. But metaphysical problems of man, who express themselves psychologically in a variety of manifestations, in a variety of aspects, can never be cured by man. Only salvation from God. Certainly not fear of death, nor death itself can be eliminated by man. I don't believe that medicine will at any time, 1,000 years from now, reach the stage at which it will be able to turn man into an immortal being. Of course, we believe in immortality, and we also believe that someday, even psychosomatic man will be immortal. But only when it will be God's will to do so. Second, Johannes believes that exploration of the entire universe, of the universe in its outskirts, in its fringes, exploration of the boundless stretches and gray uncharted plains of the astral world will never be completed. Yes, He has us as encouraged men to explore, to conquer, to rule. The latter may explore limited astral sectors, even the entire solar system. And if he wants to believe and to dream, he may make a trip. I don't know how long it will take, but according to what physicists say, in keeping with Einstein theory, if a young man will start out for a star in a different system and he'll come back home, he'll be as young as he was on the day of departure. All right? The only question is whether he'll come back home. But however, yes, and I live in my mind, I don't believe in it. I live in my saying that we'll be able to get out of our galaxy, of the Milky Way galaxy, and reach another galaxy. But this is just a small corner in the universe. The entire universe will remain an unknown mystery. The boundless uncharted planes of the dark spaces and galaxies will remain closed to man. The reason for this is a simple one, because man is finite, and who knows what the universe is. And finite man cannot explore infinity and boundlessness. Number two. I mean, now scientism, not scientism, but pseudoscientism, has become a religion for many, a calling. It is just as idolatrous as the cult of Stalin and Mao Zedong. And just as foolish. Just as foolish. Third, men will never find the answer to the mysterium magnum question. How does the universe function? You'll never answer that question. Man has accomplished a great deal with his quantifying mathematical method. However, he just establishes abstract relationships, answering the how question from within, without answering the why question from without. That will remain a secret. Mysterium magnum, mysterium tremendum, will never be resolved. Unless God will will the eschatological age to commence. Fourth, men cannot and men must not legislate the moral norm. Men should be either ready to accept morality from God or give up any attempt to live a moral life. Because in position of a secular code, secular, finite, and relative code upon society is in vain and is worthless. In my opinion, that's exactly what the original sin, the Chetah Kadmi, consisted of. Adam tried to do it, to impose, to legislate norms of good and bad, and brought disaster upon himself and mankind. Irrational man does it with arrogance, and he ends up with the law, with the moral law of immorality. So Judaism has accepted all four major aspects, and those four major aspects are former Makim, the Makim consciousness, as unalterable, God-willed, inevitable experiences of defeat. Judaism, it's very important, has spoken so beautifully
of Tchilas Velor. It's very strange that our teachings consist of two colors. Tchilas Velor. White and blue. What kind of blue? The Rambam says, blue at noon. The color of the sky at noontime. Deathlight. Light blue. Deathlight white. Rashi says, it is the color of the evening sky. Dark blue. Bordering on the planet. And it's quite interesting. When the Mishnah asked the question, when is one supposed to reach Ma? So the answer is, Mishiyakir ben Tchilas Velorim, when he is ready to discriminate, or is able to discriminate, between blue and white. Discriminate where? This is called a Yerushalmi. If you just pull out his tikkus and try to discriminate, between one or two threads of blue, or four threads of blue, and the white threads. What is the white color? The white color in Hebrew language, in Hebrew semantics, is the symbol of plainness, simplicity, intelligibility, and familiarity, friendship. If you want to say it is clear, it is certain, it's undoubted, it is without, it is, there is no doubt about it, doubtless, you say Kashemesh Batsarayim. It's as the dazzling light coming upon us from the heavens. When the Haggad disagrees with the Rambam and rebukes him, he says, Lenoyel, Lechoyel, Leboyel. There is no light, there is no whiteness, it's dark. What does the Tchilas color represent? He asks, the Gemara asks, and the Gemara answers, Tchilas Bein Aleyam, the blue color is reminiscent of the large sea, of the immense vastness of the sea, Yam Bein Elokia, the sea reflects the blueness of the sky, the Rokia Bein Elokia Kovet, and the sky, the heavens, reflect the glory of the celestial form of the transcendental Rebbeinu Shel Olam. Tchilas color, what did the Gemara want to express by it? The Tchilas color reflects distance, remoteness, beyond reach, the vast expanse of the sea, and the boundless astral distances. It reflects impenetrable mystery, enveloping the destiny of man. The tremor and fear, inspired by the incursion from time to time, of the unknown, transcendent into our lives. It happens quite often. Yehadus who warned man not to be too sure of himself, not to be overconfident, not to be too cocky, if you want to say it, and not to be over sophisticated, too clever. And Yehadus kept on telling us, and this runs like a red thread throughout our literature, from antiquity until the Sifrim, to the Sifrim Musa of contemporary scholars. There are intelligible factors in reality which are flooded with the white, dazzling light. Everything in those sectors is clear, understandable, and intimate. In those sectors, one enjoys warmth and sweetness. However, there are also sectors enveloped in the dark blue of the mysterious evening sky. where man feels like a homeless wanderer who just happened to cross into a strange, foreboding territory. The transition from one sector, from the white sector, to another is quick and sudden. Chemes of the evening sky replaces Lovon of the bright day unexpectedly. How was it by the night of the autumn? How was it 7 years ago? We don't try to invest to explore our own experiences. How was it? It was very simple. I was enjoying the bright day of my life, full of color and sun. The years had passed since I went through a serious abdominal operation, and God helped me to recover from that illness. There was, Baruch Hashem, no recurrence. It seemed to me as if everything was going to be simple, white, and magnificent, like the dazzling light of the noon sky, and that I'll be able to study Torah mitoch osher, of course, with an aleph, not with an ayin. And the same evening, she told me, I have to enter the hospital for just observation. And suddenly the bright day, in a matter of minutes, turned into a dark, bleak, dreary, abominable night. Transition from Lovon to Tcheles is a very quick and abrupt one. How was it in Shushan? Habira. A day before, they feasted. Jewish Empire, courtier, and Ishihudi together drank toast and hugged each other. And in a matter of hours, the pistols were sent out with the couriers, were hushing, were hurried, were hurried, to destroy, to slay, and to kill. Yahadus says, I'm sorry, it's contrary to the American philosophy of pursuit of happiness. I'm sorry, I have to be lapicurus as far as the Declaration of Independence is concerned. You'll excuse me, I mean, we have an Irish city of people who watch for it because it watch out for it. I beg mercy, I should have been clear. I'm going to go ahead because it. The pursuit of happiness contradicts the finiteness awareness. And the finiteness awareness in Yahadus expresses itself in one word: man's insecurity vis-à-vis the future. Because man is a being who lives in time. He does not live in the present moment. The present moment is only a link. He lives in the past. And he lives in the future. He remembers the past and anticipates the future. He feels nostalgia as far as the past is concerned. It's a devastating nostalgia. Many things he could have accomplished, and he didn't. I would give my right arm, to use a colloquialism, if I could just speak for 5 minutes. With one of the 3 people I just lost 3 years ago. Just for 5 minutes. I tried to speak to them, standing at their graves. Today, to the fair grave, I addressed myself there. There was no answer. Or perhaps the answer was lost, I don't know. I couldn't hear. This is the nostalgia for something that was within my reach and I did not exploit that opportunity. I did not take advantage of it. Kind of nostalgia. Mevochei Kavishem Nirei. One begins to appreciate God when he is at a distance from him, remote. When God is very close, orgiastic man doesn't appreciate him. Nostalgia is a part of the human mima maki, but then there is insecurity in the future. I try to gain a glimpse in the future. Only fools can speak of security. Unless they identify security with the stock market, it's a very bad equation now. But what do you mean, man's security? I always say, now I move my finger, my index finger. But I'll be able to move the finger 5 minutes from now. God knows, I don't know. And Chazal has considered every morning the man wakes up, stands on his feet, as the day of Tchiyas Amazing. Because unconscious man regained his consciousness. The miracle of Tchiyas Amazing in miniature, according to Chazal, happens and occurs every morning. When sleeping man, unconscious man, wakes up and regains his awareness, I do exist, and my existence as a practice most probably. Man's insecurity, this is actually the word which expresses in toto the finiteness, awareness, the mina mitza kvasiko, or mina makin kvasiko. And man's insecurity lies at the very root of prayer. Without the finiteness awareness, without man's insecurity, there would be no prayer. The latter is the response to human misery stemming from the mimamakim awareness. So let me just explain to you in short. Prayer, whether of biblical or rabbinic origin, doesn't matter now. We don't have to engage in the controversy between the Rambam and the Ramban, whether prayer is midrashic or midrabbanan. But whether biblical or rabbinic bears witness to one unalterable fact, namely that man is always in need. He has to emphasize the petitional aspect of feeling. Hymn, prologue, and epilogue are just secondary importance. The act of praying is the religious response to need, to the experience of sorrow, of distress, existential strait, narrowness. Minameta, when man feels trapped and defeated, many passages in the Bible will confirm the link of sorrow with tefillah. The chapter which Esther recited when she was about to enter the royal court. Only then is prayer meaningful when it dawns upon man. The mother of man is too foolish and he is not conscious of it. That his situation is a tragic one. That he is utterly defeated. That there is nobody to help him but God. Prayer and crisis are inexplicably linked up. Of course, the question rises immediately. If the crisis awareness is indispensable for prayer, how can prayer be recited daily? At times of peace and prosperity and success and victory, how can I say Refrain by the Shem Benerofe if I just this morning, came from the doctor and gave me a thorough checkup and gave me what we call it in colloquial English, a clean bill of health? So what sense does the Refrain have? Or what sense does the Baruch Aleinu, the same Baruch Aleinu, have?
if I have a check bank account in the bank? Do it have a sense or doesn't it have a sense? Apparently it has a sense. What is the sense? In the insecurity of man. Now I'm healthy. How I'll feel next morning, I don't know. There is future and present linked up. And this is the idea of prayer. And this lies at the root of the idea of prayer. The finiteness awareness of man. It is his nostalgia, devastating, completely unreal. He wants something which he can never get. He wants contact with the world which is gone long ago. He wants communication, communion with persons who are not here around anymore. They are far, far away. He wants many things because he was a fool. He missed them while they were around. He could just have, all he had to do is to stretch out his arm. He could reach them. He could have reached them. And insecurity of man. The second aspect of crisis of the finiteness of awareness of the mocking of inner nature. Now let me just finish. However, prayer in the house, I want you to understand that, is not just a recital. It is more than that. It is a world outlook, and it is also a way of life. Because prayer, what is the term, the halachic term for prayer? Tefillah is all right, of course, but there's another term, the prime term for prayer, Aveda Shepreya. Aveda means, if you work, if you translate prayer into your daily life, into deeds, of course, we said that prayer is the answer which Yehadus gives, or the response of Yehadus to the Minamakim or Minamitzer awareness. The question is, yes, it is the answer. The insecurity of man, when I am with God, I feel secure. And that's why, in my great agony and misery, on a period, not 3 years, but almost 7 years, I found companionship in the Torah. I've never learned as much as I did the last 7 years. Because I felt, while I studied, I've been studying, that someone behind me, stands behind me, casting a furtive glance, leaning over my shoulder, and casting a furtive glance into the bloody mirror, and silently asking me, what are you studying? And that awareness of unseen presence has kept me, has guided me, has made me survive, physically and intellectually and emotionally. Prayer is not enough. There must be a way of life which is prayerful, saturated with the idea of prayer, permeated with the philosophy of prayer and the metaphysics of prayer. What is the way of life on which prayer reflects? Let me tell you that now. I'll finish. A prayer to life signifies first a consecrated life. Yehadus believes that each man, I mentioned it last year, but I'm developing it in a different fashion. Yehadus believed that each man has an assignment. A man is not born, is not cast, as the existentialists say, into this world in vain. For no purpose, for no reason, is burdened with an assignment. Each man, in the opinion of Yehadus, is anointed, not appointed. Appointed, yes, but even anointed by the Almighty
to contribute something to redemption, toward the arrival of the eschatological age, to the great redemption. In other words, a drop of the holy oil, Shemen HaMishre, of consecration, fell on the head of every Jew. He is called to participate in the great march of generations who have been blazing the trail for the Melech HaMashiach since the dawn of our history. Each Jew is the herald, the harbinger of the Melech HaMashiach. Melech HaMashiach in the nature, all by himself, because he blazes the trail for the great Melech HaMashiach. Each Jew has a messianic, eschatological assignment. And each Jew should think, I was born for one purpose only. This is the prayerful way of thinking. To serve. God has laid claim on me. Or does lay claim on me. He wants me for his service. It's a plain pasuk in Israel. The old Jewish hymn, which has been echoing through the millennia and centuries, certainly says that man belongs to God. If entire creation is his property, so man, Allah has come on, And if he belongs to God, so he is consecrated to the service of God. He is a Messiah in miniature. And when I speak of service, I mean two kinds of service. One service is the continuous one. Life itself is a service. Takarish Baruch. If man knows how to live, if man knows how to plot his course, if a man knows how to respond to experiences, if man knows how to pray and how to treat his fellow man, this itself is a service. However, there is another service, a one-timely service, which in times of emergency, when a special urgent appeal addressed by God to man, reaches him. Such an appeal, you know very well, was addressed, and perhaps my wife used to say, this is the gist of the entire Megillas Esther, was addressed to Esther. Such an appeal. It was just one timely, in a crisis, in an emergency situation, was an appeal addressed to Esther. Lovei lifnei al-melech, al-melech will evacuate in front of Allah. Such an appeal was addressed to Abraham, even though Abraham's life in its entirety was a service to God, was consecrated. But no one can get away from the one family appeal, which begins to echo through the uncharted spaces, separating us from the Almighty. Kachnu es birchu es echidcho, es yitcho kasher hafto. Such a petition is submitted to each individual who wants in a life. The service which individual is called upon to perform is singular, which only he, the individual to whom the appeal was addressed, is capable of rendering. No one else can do the job.
which the Ashkoche has assigned to him. The service requested of Esther was of a singular nature, and according to Mordechai's philosophy, Esther, who was born and made clean, in order she should perform one service, which took her just a couple of hours. Midera, in Leicht Koseis, Kadat Ramalkus, who knows, whether thou art not come to the royal estate for such a time as this. I would just add two words. And who knows if you hadn't been born just for that purpose? And who knows if God hadn't bestowed beauty and charm upon you just for that purpose? The time has come. The call for some death. Esther was done. This is one prayerful way of life. Of course, there's a second aspect to it. A messianic consecrated life, a life of service, is ipso facto a courageous life. It's a courageous life. What does a courageous life mean? I would rather use the term heroic. Why? It's a heroic life. And I have been saying it for a long time. If someone should ask me, what does Yahavus want of us? I would give him one answer. To live heroically. To live courageously. To live with fortitude. Heroic life, Yehadus disliked cowardice. Yehadus had contempt, I wouldn't say dislike, had contempt, for a mercantile logic. The logic of a businessman. I am not present company experience, if there is some businessman in there, I know it. The businessman logic, the pragmatic utilitarian logic, which is too astute and too cautious, and which tells man that he must not begin unless he knows for sure that he is able to fix it. Courageous life or heroic action is based fundamentally, motivated not by pragmatic utilitarian, mercantile, discursive, logical reasoning, because this reasoning is at best a coward, with that levels. But is inspired rather, by intuitive insights, by spiritual perceptions, which are beyond the reach of the logical formal analysis. As a matter of fact, the most important decision, as a matter of fact, this is true of every man, Jew and non-Jew alike, the most important decisions in one's life are reached in the intuitive rather than in the logical dimension. The Jew of old, the dying human, and the Jew of today, who has to do the same job, to defy not only one human, but the entire world, is not guided by syllogistic inferences. Because had he been very guided by those inferences, he would never dare to defy the world, to confront the world. Had he inquired, had made an inquiry, how the strictly practical, a bit pompous logos, he would have received an answer in the negative. From the logical, rational viewpoint, those relations, those rebellions, this defiance, this type of confrontation is plainly suicidal. Mordechai's defiance of Haman was suicidal. Esther's risking her life and obeying the lives of millions of Jews was logically unwarranted. She did because, as Chazal said, Vayim Ashlishi Vatilbash Esther Malchus, the Spirit of God has descended upon her. She was inspired. And, in conclusion, a courageous life, a service life, dedicated service, means a heroic life. A heroic life means sacrificial life. And the highest form of sacrifice for a human being is not to give his life. No. The highest form of sacrifice, the way Yahweh has understood it, is his readiness to leave the stage after he had played his part aside to him and vanished in anonymity and oblivion. More than a person wants to live, a person wants to be remembered. Remembered by individuals, remembered by society. Remember that he has accomplished something. This quest for being remembered, for not being forgotten, is so powerful. I remember, I myself can reproduce instances many years ago when a poor woman used to bring me money in Boston. I should place her name on the memorial tablet in our yeshiva. And she used to count, we used to charge $100 for a plaque. And she used to count the money and her hands were trembling. And one quarter, and another quarter, and the third quarter, and the fourth quarter. And I used to ask her, tell me, my dear lady, how much savings do you have? What's my last savings? It's all the time of the depression. So why do you give the money to the yeshiva? You can't afford to do it. Rebbe, Yechvila Mezor, and Isht Fagesen, I want to be remembered. Once I will die, I know my children will never remember me. They'll never come to shul to say, Yisker. Perhaps the yeshiva will remember once in a while that I was an old man. And this is not just the mentality of a primitive, unlettered, illiterate man, but a very honest one, a sincere one. This is the mentality of Western man. When Johnson accepted the vice presidency offered by Kennedy, and it was a degrading acceptance, I would say disgraceful acceptance. So one of the journalists asking, why did you accept it? After as majority leader of the Senate, you have wielded so much power and influence, actually. The president was, you commanded the respect of the White House, and now the vice president, you know what a vice president means in America. You'll just be an errand boy for the president. So the answer is yes, yes. But history will give two more lines to the vice president than to the majority leader of the Senate. History will devote a few more words to the vice president than to the majority leader of the Senate. Power at present means nothing. I'll be remembered. That's what Johnson said. And Johnson is not a metaphysician, nor a philosopher, nor a man of exceptional spiritual perceptions. Even though he acted like a man as far as Eretz Yisrael is concerned. But this is correct. And Yahadu's demands of man anonymity. Let me give you an example. There are many boys who study Gemara here. But how many girls are here studying Gemara? I don't know. But boys like study Mishnah. Stam Mishnah. Or you study Mishnah and there's a controversy with an individual and we call him the Tanekame. Who is the Tanekame? Who is he? So you ask me, who the Tanekame? You answer me, you ask who the Tanekame is? This is the majority of Jewish scholars. Like other names. Who is the Tanei Batra? You don't know. Tono Abraham. Who are they? Why were the Braise Warhol records? Were so stingy? So tight-lipped in enumerating the names. It is not just a coincidence. It is not laziness or neglect on the part of our Chazal. It's a method. It's a policy. The greatest of all sacrifices a Jew brings when he's ready to sink into oblivion and remain in the shadows of anonymity. The orgiastic society, as well as the tyrannical, arrogant society, attempt to overcome human finiteness, the mimamakim awareness, by substituting public memory for metaphysical immortality. Yehudus did not accept it. On the contrary, it considered the quest for having one's name recorded in history as sheer vanity. The individual as such can never become a historical figure. Only the covenantal community is perpetuated by history, has claim an historical immortality. The service which the individual gives to the community is recorded. What is private life is never recorded. The very moment the service is completed, history is not concerned with him anymore. The ideal cathartic experience is that of anonymity. How many facts did the Torah record pertaining to the lives of the patriarchs or Moses? Only those periods were recorded which were directly intertwined with the service they rendered to the covenantal community. There is never a complete biography, only fragments have been selected, namely those which tell us about the sacrificial surrender of the individual to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Those who echo the great word Achineni, which rings through endless spaces, I am ready and willing to serve. Nothing else but the Hineni was recorded. It's very strange. We know much more about Aristotle and Socrates and Plato than we know about the Vilna Gaon. I mean biographical data. Very little. What do I know about my father? Very little. He never talked about himself. He never wrote an autobiography. He never reminisced. I just know some episodes. What do I know about the life of my grandfather after crying? Just single episode. He never confided their private affairs, their private experiences, their clandestine emotions to anyone. Whatever happened, happened between them and God. It has never been made public. This is an aspect of anonymity. God requires of man the highest of all sacrifices, anonymity, which is genuine humility. He hates glamour, fame, external glitter, and certainly vainglory. He loves the actor or the actress who appears on the stage for a short while, plays his or her part humbly, and disappears immediately without receiving applause. Man stands in the limelight as long as he is the Messiah, the anointed who consecrated himself to the covenantal community. The very moment he finishes his job, the lights are dimmed, or rather extinguished, and he is out of sight. What does the Megillah tell us about Mordechai HaYehudi and Esther HaMalka's? What did the Megillah tell us about Esther HaMalka's life following the Haman episode? After all, she was a young girl when she was taken to the palace. She lived for many more years. I would like to know, did she remain the queen in Persia, or Ahasuerus sent her back to Mordechai and invited Shargash and a boy to find another queen for him? It would have been quite curious to know about it. The Megillah doesn't mention one word. Tichtei v'esmei bat Zavichayim, Esther HaMalka bat Zavichayim, Esigeres HaPurim Azei Sashenis. And the story is finished. And she has removed herself from the stage. What do we know about Mordechai Yehudi? What we know? Nothing. We know the Yesa for Roshas Guas Mordechai, Asher Gidle HaMelech, Halem Ksubim Al Sefer Divrei HaYomim, the Malchim Mordechai for us. Go ahead and find them and read the story. Yes. One episode, and a very short one, of their lives was recorded. The rest is anonymous. And if somebody would, and that's exactly what Micha said, I gave the word on Matev, umadish and derish mimcho, kimaseis mishpot, ve'avas chesed, ve'atna leches imenekecho. It has been told thee, O man, what is God, what the Lord doth require of thee, only to do justly and to walk humbly. I would say rather anonymously. Who is thy God? Anyway, we must underline the word humbly. And this is our answer to the Makim Minamitza.